is so cold.
How cold is it?
It's chilly.
It's been no joke with the cold air for the lower 48. Really, we've been looking at temperatures running 15 to even 30 degrees below average.
So that is very, very cold.
Holy cow. I think that coal is like a melt up. Stocks now getting closer to 20,000. 142 more points added on to that Augusta Dow average today. That is a record.
That's a big number.
I think the number one challenge for the entire Republican team, House, Senate, and White House, is going to be to take the Trump rally and turn it next year into a Trump reality.
I am asking you to dream big and bold and daring things for your country. I am asking you to believe in yourself, and I'm asking you to believe again in America. It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Another good week for investors as the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 head to record levels. The Santa Claus rally continues on Wall Street this week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in hour one is Ari Wald. He's technical analyst for Oppenheimer & Company, and he's saying, in like a bear, meaning this is how we began the year, and out like a bull. He's very bullish. A lot of the indicators that he follows, from breadth to leadership to interest rate spreads, commodity prices, and also the overall trend of the market itself has strengthened from where it's been 12 months ago. He is bullish. So you're going to want to hear what Ari wants to say. And then also joining me later on in the program is John Eng from Maison Placement. He's still bullish on gold as he ticks off a number of factors why he believes gold prices are heading higher. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. We are facing right now what we are calling a global paradigm shift. It's affecting politics, it's affecting economics, and to a certain degree, it actually affects religion and worldviews and ethics and morals. The president is coming in. The new president will be Donald Trump as President Obama exits the Oval Office. And we are discovering that the presidency of Donald Trump will start with significantly different conditions than those of Mr. Obama or Mr. Bush before him, especially as far as Fed policy. So despite all of the media pronouncements about this and that, what is the real state of the economy right now, and what are the challenges the new president is going to face when he comes into office, and how will the media handle that? It's an important thing to consider because, well, we're heading in that direction. All of that will be the discussion today on The Big Picture. And Ryan Poplava, you cannot say that times are not interesting right now, both in politics and, of course, the way politics is affecting the market. It seems the Trump rally continues to bear fruit this week as the major U.S. stock indices hit fresh highs. Now, you had been talking about some of the positive drivers even before the election found Trump as the president-elect by the electoral vote. There's obviously that controversy going on between the electoral versus the popular vote. And that suggests that the uncertainty of the election was the only thing that was holding the markets back. So are you still convinced that that's the case?
Yeah, John, at least for the intermediate term, economic numbers continue to improve. And we saw that specifically this week in the Chinese trade data. And the imports were up 6.7%. Exports were up 4.4% in November. And, you know, not just U.S. economy is doing well. We talked about that over the last few weeks. PMIs are moving back up. Purchasing Managers Index. The jobs report wasn't as big as we had expected it, you know, last week. But there's many other things that are playing in here, and especially what's going on overseas. There's been definitely some improvement in Europe, improvement in China, like I just mentioned. And specifically, again, looking at China's data, a thing of note was the notable increase in commodity importation. You don't just grab onto a whole bunch of commodities out there because of short-term changes and infrastructure changes, that's for like long-term planning. And I think that's a great story for many of the industrial global growth and cyclical stocks that are performing right now. It's not just a technical thing that's happening, money pouring into these areas. It's, we're seeing some fundamental results that are justifying that. And that to me is that fusion between fundamental analysis and technical that kind of float my boat. But, you know, looking at the commodity producers themselves, which have performed recently, you know, I firmly believe they're coming out of that 5-year bear market this year. I've seen it technically since the beginning of the year. And it's just, like I said, it's just nice to see that the economic news is really coinciding with that technical picture. And that changed actually early this year. I started investing for some of our clients and commodity producers way back in January in that correction. My brother did it in the bonds of those companies, which were just highly underpriced. We were getting bonds priced at 90 cents on the dollar. So I'm just real happy to see that that's continuing. And we've got some great fundamentals that are improving. The other thing that's feeding this stock rally is the flows. And I mentioned that, John, a couple of weeks ago when I was last on the show, you and I, we took a look at the ICI reports showing the mutual fund flows, the exchange traded fund flows. Anybody can Google this data. You just Google ICI and fund flows and you'll get this data. And where we last left off, we saw that there was some money coming out of bonds, a quick influx into bonds right before the elections. And that's where we last looked at the data. I didn't have anything that was post the elections, but I had a theory that, you know, we're seeing some money rotating out of bonds, and totally correct. You know, you look at as of the week ending November 16th, so one full week after the elections, $23 billion entered domestic equity funds and ETFs, and about $9.7 billion left bonds. So major rotation there, and we have been seeing that in following weeks after that initial data, all the way through November. So the last data point we looked at was November 30th. We saw that criteria happening, money leaving bonds, money entering into stocks. So it wouldn't surprise me to see that again next week when we get the results for what happened from Wednesday this week to Wednesday next week, if that is going to continue, because that's what we're seeing both in bonds and stocks.
All right, leaving that behind, what else happened this week besides the rotation out of bonds and into stocks?
There were some interesting ones. The ECB met, and that was a big policy decision this week. We'll get, obviously, the FOMC next week. But some little items, you know, nothing really major affected the market in general. Nothing like the election was and paradigm shifting. But some small stories. Trump talked about healthcare. He basically said he was going to bring down prices in a Time magazine article. There was the Goldman Sachs conference on financials. So we got to hear from Wall Street talk about what's going on in the economy, in the financials, and a lot of optimism by the executives. Interest rates have come up, so their net interest rate margins are getting better. I read an article in Washington Post saying that actually this could be a big issue for, you know, if we see interest rates spiking in a very short amount of time, what that does to the portfolios of all these banks in bonds does not help. It does not help. So, you know, in some areas, higher interest rates are helping the banks. Other areas, it's actually hurting their investments in bonds. Those were some key stories talking about healthcare. When Trump made that statement, healthcare just got crushed while the rest of the market really took off. And then there was a Macau ATM limit announcement that hit specifically that industry group for the casinos and such, Wynn Resorts, anyway, that has exposure there, that China was going to limit the amount of cash that ATM withdrawers could take out. And I think it's like around $600 US. So they maximized it of what can be taken out. And some, I think Las Vegas Sands, the CEO, was saying that it hurts, but it doesn't change the long-term story of Macau and their optimism there. So some small things, you know, affecting this and that. The European Central Bank, their decision was really the big event this week among a lot of Trump sayings.
Yeah, it seems so. What are some of the counter drivers here to recent market and political events? I mean, just as you see it here.
Like we've seen since 2014, one of the big catalysts that trading desks are talking about is the large multinationals, right, have reported difficult earnings performance in the past. all as a result, the dollar was always the key component that they addressed in their conferences. And so if we see the dollar strengthening, which we have recently in the last few weeks, like looking at 13-year highs here, the last time the dollar's been this strong was 2002. So that's a big risk to this rally, is what effect that's going to have on the large multinational stocks. Those are stocks that are in the S&P 500, the Dow industrials. So that's a major concern going into, I would say, the first quarter earnings season next year. So if that's going to be discussed, if these conferences and the earnings announcements are going to say that we're concerned about that, that's going to be my concern as an investor. So that's something to maybe discuss in the future. But another risk is, like I said, Trump was in the news quite a bit this week. One of the biggest parts was, yes, the healthcare thing, but a lot of foreign policy discussion here and controversy. Trump had accepted a call from Taiwan, and that created some bad blood with China already, because the U.S. has never formally recognized Taiwan as an independent nation. That really rubbed China wrong. And so Trump made some comments about China this week, which I don't know if you've ever seen that funny YouTube where he says China about 50,000 times, but let's hear what he has to say.
One of the most important relationships we must improve, and we have to improve, is our relationship with China. They haven't played by the rules, and I know it's time that they're going to start. They're going to start. They've got to. We're all in this thing together, folks. We got to play by the rules, folks. You have the massive theft of intellectual property, putting unfair taxes on our companies, not helping with the menace of North Korea like they should, and the at-will and massive devaluation of their currency and product dumping. Other than that, they've been wonderful, right?
That was President-elect Trump's comments this week. It was a clip that Business Insider carried about China.
Yeah, so, you know, these comments came right about, you know, all that discussion over Taiwan and the controversy there. So this will be interesting. You know, some American companies think their China opportunity is over. I read an article recently about that, and I think that's a bit rash, but I'm just saying, trade wars, if they get stoked here with a Trump administration, that's not good for business and financial markets in the short term. If things can get resolved better for U.S. companies, yes, long term, that's going to be great. So we'll just have to watch. You know, the first countries Trump visits, typically, you know, a new president jumping in and visiting countries, that basically tells you who is right in his crosshairs, whose relationships he feel are the most important to his foreign policy. So that will be definitely a big focus for the markets next year. It was regulations with Obama. I think it's going to be possible trade wars, but also deregulation with Trump.
And Ryan, what about monetary policy? I mean, we have the European Central Bank meeting this week. And of course, up to bat next week is going to be the Fed's Open Market Committee meeting. How are investors reacting to the extension of the ECB's bond buying program and taper?
Yeah, the extension was largely anticipated by Wall Street, and some had estimated we might hear something about Draghi wanting to taper, as we did get a small dose of that discussion at the last meeting, where he basically suggested that they are discussing their exit strategy. That was the first time it was mentioned. And I'm not sure anybody was expecting anything official immediately like we saw, but it did. And that was basically suggesting that, yes, they're going to extend the bond purchase program for another 6 months. So March, I think September of next year, but they are going to begin a taper, which means they start to decelerate, I guess, how much they're adding to their balance sheet. And that hit the euro. But European stocks jumped on the news, given just the expectations it's being done because things are getting better, because the taper will be gradual, like the FOMC has been doing for a couple years now. So, you know, next week, a hike is being baked into the cake for the Federal Open Market Committee, for the Federal Reserve. And that's been that way for some time. We were at 60-something percent like 4 months ago, and now it's way up there. So, you know, we'll just have a lot of wait and see anticipation for Trump's changes to policy. Like I said, it will be the same for Yellen. You know, Yellen can't just say, oh, okay, he's going to do away with Dodd-Frank. He's going to do away with these Department of Labor changes, and therefore we should be, you know, aggressive in raising interest rates. No. She's got to be data dependent, and she's got to wait and see what Trump decides, how that may affect the country, deregulating, cutting taxes, also maybe reducing revenues initially. So there's going to be a lot of pushback and forth between monetary policy and fiscal policy next year. That'll be nice. You know, we've always just talked about monetary policy. It'll be nice to talk about fiscal policy for once.
Well, you can't say that these are not interesting times, you know, Ryan. It's turned out to be a more interesting November and December than I actually thought it was going to be. But we'll see what it's like going for the rest of the month and into the new year.
Yeah, elections in general have been very surprising this year, haven't they? The Italian referendum, that was largely expected a no, and it did happen. Didn't really move markets much. Didn't do anything this week. But Trump, he's been moving the markets, not just from his being voted in, but his comments. They're being watched very closely.
Okay, Ryan, see you again next week. Look forward to it.
Sounds good, John. We'll talk to you then.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Well, we have a new president-elect that'll be assuming office in January of next year. And with that will come some changes to the tax laws. Republicans have had plans in the works for years and have been unable to pass them. Well, the new president-elect says tax reform is on the top of the agenda. Well, what is this going to mean for estate planning? Joining me on the program is Adam Sherry from the estate firm of Anderson & Yoakum. And Adam, why don't we begin with the laws the way they are now, and what will change, if anything, in 2017 prior to any tax law proposals coming from the president-elect?
You know, that's a great question because, you know, I know that I've been getting a lot of questions, and some of the concerns from some of our clients is that, you know, they're going to have to worry about this as of January 1. And what's nice is to know that we have some time to plan. So the law is pretty much already set as far as 2017 is concerned, and it's not a huge change from what we saw during 2016.
Well, here we are. The stock market is at record levels. More importantly, one of the oldest technical indicators, Dow Theory, with the industrials breaking out to a new record along with transports. What does that signify for the markets coming up ahead? Joining me on the program is Ari Wald. He is technical analyst at Oppenheimer & Company. Ari, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thanks for inviting me on.
It was a pleasure reading your latest piece, Inflection Points, and that's where I want to begin, in like a bear, out like a bull, because a lot of people have been taken by surprise the way the markets took off after the election of Trump. There was widely predicted. I don't know if, Ari, were you watching Election Eve? I can remember at one point the Dow futures were down 800 points, and what was it the next day? It was up 300. So it's taken a lot of people by surprise, but I want to go over some of the things that you're talking about, your indicators. So basically sticking with your newsletter and then also talking about one of the oldest technical indicators is Dow Theory.
Yeah. You know, thinking back on election night too. Yeah. I had a restless night because we have been bullish for, you know, really since the springtime, calling for a resumption of this bull market. And as I saw futures ticking another 100 points lower pretty much every hour, you know, I had my marketing handout ready to go, and I said, oh, man, all my charts are going to be broken. But then to wake up the next morning and see everything fine, I was it was really a pretty nice sigh of relief. And I think what we've seen since then, this very strong risk-on rally post-election, you know, one, I think it was really in the charts ahead of time. Even if you look at the 5% pullback we had from August to early November, it was investors selling their safety stocks, their defensive sectors, while accumulating the transports and the banks, and those areas had held up much better. And now are the areas taking us higher. And so we see this as the quote-unquote right leadership that typically characterizes a continuation in trend rather than a reversal. So we've run up a lot in a short amount of time. We're well aware that, you know, uptrends don't develop in straight lines. There's going to be fits and starts. But, you know, the takeaway we've been expressing to clients is that equity should be maintained, that you don't want to time these near-term bull pullbacks. You want to buy them because how we see it, we think the bull market continues in 2017.
You know, Ari, one of the things that has been very surprising for the markets this year, that we've had a number of surprises. We began the year with almost 6 weeks down and with the market expecting aggressive rate hikes, one every quarter coming from the Fed. That hasn't happened, though it's widely expected they'll go next week. Then we had Brexit. We had 2 days of correction and then one of the best summer rallies in a long time. And likewise with the election eve night when Trump was winning, when the Dow futures were down almost 800 points. Now we have both the Dow transports and most major indexes at new records. I want to talk about something that you wrote about. And as you look at the indicators that you follow, you said compared to where we used to be, let's say a year ago, number one, internal breadth is broader. Two, leadership is cyclical. Three, credit spreads are narrowing. Four, commodity prices have stabilized. Five, interest rates are moving in the right direction. And six, the overall trend is stronger now. Can you comment on those six indicators?
And that's a really important point. One, the differences between now and where we were last year ahead of that very steep Q1 correction. And it also speaks of another important point. You know, looking at those different factors, whether we're talking about internal breadth, leadership, some of those inner market trends, you know, credit spreads, you know, what I would define as risk indicators. Many of them peaked in 2014, and they had been in a 2-year decline. We've been saying since the start of the year that we've already been in this 2-year bear market in terms of risk that is finally just starting to turn the corner. And it was a reason why there were some technical concerns last year when we were making new highs in 2015, but those risk indicators had already started to peak out and move lower. And those divergences, bearish divergences, that's kind of the times to get concerns, have been relieved. And what we've seen really starting first off the February low and continuing through each part of that, through the post-Brexit move and now since the post-election move too, is all those risk indicators have inflected higher and are now marking what we would view as a healthy bull market and a continuation in trend, you know, speaking in terms of the breadth of the market. You know, typically late in the cycle, what's going to happen is that investors are going to start rotating into larger cap stocks, and you'll have strength in the cap-weighted indexes that masks weakness in more smaller cap stocks. And that's usually a sell signal. It tends to characterize a market top, and usually the next step is that you have your market decline. We're not seeing that right now. What we're seeing instead is actually more early to mid-cycle conditions that would suggest that we're not yet at that point where we have to worry about a major decline in the market.
Let me bring something that could maybe alter this. The market is anticipating with the election of Donald Trump that there's going to be tax cuts, which are going to be stimulative for the economy. There's also going to be large fiscal spending in the way of infrastructure and defense spending. What would happen to this market? Because the other thing that's been rising along with stock prices have been bond yields. I think we're roughly around 1.8 on 10-year treasuries. And on the day you and I are doing this interview, treasuries are close to 2.4%. How long can interest rates keep going up and stocks keep going up at the same time?
Historically, you know, we're of the view that, you know, when speaking about the relationship between interest rates and the stock market, I think it's both looking at the level as well as the direction of interest rates. You know, in general, we're of the view that low and rising interest rates, good for stocks. This is a signal of growth coming back to the market. And what we'd actually be more concerned about if rates started to move lower again, that would be the deflationary concern that would give us some pause and think that potentially, you know, equities could be next to correct. So, you know, and I think a great example of that, you know, why investors shouldn't be worried about this, you know, very significant backup we had in interest rates. If you look back to the 1950s and 1960s, coming out of a period of significantly low interest rates for 1 to 2 decades, it was really when interest rates started to move higher again in the 1950s that characterized that secular bull market in the S&P 500. We think we could be at a similar juncture. A lot of our indicators are pointing to that the S&P 500 has been in a new secular advance since 2013. I think commodity prices are confirming that. And I think now that the action we're seeing in interest rates, this big backup, could be confirming that as well, that if we do get this significant move in interest rates, to us, that's a good thing. That's global growth coming back to the markets.
And what about the inflationary aspects of this? Because as interest rates have risen, if stock prices have risen, the dollar has also gone up and gold prices have fallen. Can you comment on what's happened to commodities and the dollar at the same time we've had rising interest rates? Well, faster economic growth and rising interest rates would be a strength for the dollar. What about inflation?
It's interesting. We've had some conflicting signals here. We've had rates go up and commodities go up. That's inflationary. Stronger dollar, I view as deflationary. So that's been the outlier here, is what's the dollar signaling? If you really look back in 2014, it was that big surge in the dollar that caused a lot of the disruptions in the market, that caused commodity prices to push them into free fall, and in turn caused a lot of the internal disruptions in the equity market as well. So the dollar is going to be an important signal and something we're watching very carefully. But for the most part, we have seen commodity prices buck that trend. Now, we do believe we're in a commodity super cycle bear market, that commodity prices are likely going to be range bound over the coming years, that even after that massive decline we've had, you know, since commodity prices peaked a couple years ago, that we shouldn't be betting for a V reversal higher. We do think there's a ceiling out there for commodity prices. We don't think we've seen it just yet. Now, if you look back historically, that's the setup when equities have tended to do best. When you have some inflation, but not too much of it. And I think that's what we have right now. If you look back historically, range-bound commodity markets, and I think that's a terrific proxy for what inflation is. In the 1950s and 1960s, range-bound commodity markets coinciding with a secular bull market in the S&P 500. 1980s and 1990s, range-bound commodity markets coinciding with a secular bull market in the S&P 500. So stocks like inflation. They like a little bit of inflation. That, I think, is what we're seeing. They don't like too much of it. And we haven't had that just yet. To get your economic bust, you need to have your economic boom. And if you look at commodity prices as your proxy for that, for inflation, for your economic boom, we're really nowhere close to that when you consider oil was trading at $100 a couple years ago, now trading closer to $50. This could be a trend that's just getting started.
Let's talk about what has happened since this rally began following the election of Donald Trump. Prior to that, we had a lot of what I call your disinflationary or safety trade. You saw consumer staples do well, utilities do well, REITs, telecoms. Since November 8th, you've seen leadership move in opposite directions. You've got industrials doing well. You have financials doing well. You have energy. And recently, we've had a pullback on technology, which you would expect in a strengthening economy. Technology would be a leader. Comment first on technology and the other sectors that you see money rotating in and doing well.
First, for technology, what's interesting, it's been a relative source of funds, but it's really been in the more of the larger cap names that had a terrific run over the past 2 years. So we have seen some rotation into some of the areas of the market that hadn't run up as much as technology. But if you dig into it a little bit closer and inspect technology, really the equal weighted sector has done very well post-election, both pre and post-election. The small cap technology space has done exceptionally well, both pre and post-election. And our favorite area of the technology sector as well, the semiconductor group, has done very well, both pre and post-election. So I would argue that tech as a whole is still a very strong, broadly based. I think speaking in terms of the secular bull market, we are in one. I think this is a terrific candidate to lead that secular bull, not only in 2017, potentially beyond as well, when you consider it's a sector that's still retracing the very stark underperformance suffered from 2000 to 2002. So from a near-term trading basis, we view any sort of relative weakness in tech as simply healthy consolidation after a very strong run-up. And I think looking into 2017, it's a sector that continues to take us higher. The defensive sectors that you mentioned, we're a little bit more concerned about. Consumer staples, utilities, REITs, that these have been the main source of funds more recently. And I think they're the sectors that exhibit the most bearish relative trends. I think it's an absolute versus relative argument. In absolute terms, a rising tide does tend to lift all boats. We're bullish on equities, and I think we could be at a point where some of those defensive areas start to stabilize and build a base in absolute terms. But in relative terms, I think they are at risk to underperform versus a rising equity market.
So the other areas that you see doing well, industrials, which would fit in with the Trump presidency, he's talking about bringing back jobs, manufacturing, financials with the steepening yield curve, and then also with the loosening of regulations, energy. If the economy strengthens and grows at a faster rate, we're consuming more energy. And also if regulations are lifted on the energy sector, we could be producing more of it. So let's talk about industrials, financials, and energy.
And that rounds out our top four sectors, along with technology, that we think are going to be the areas that take the bull market higher in 2017. Now, a couple of them, financials, industrials, have run up a lot in a short amount of time. We view this as meaningful strength, but we think it is a new uptrend. They've run up so much, they are due for some pause, but we think it's very likely that you'll see a consolidation through time, not necessarily by price. And I think just given the nature of the strength that we're seeing, most likely pullbacks are going to be met with buying demand, and we're going to see higher lows followed by higher highs. Energy as well. You know, as crude oil finds a bottom here and begins to stabilize, we think West Texas crude oil could rally towards $60 in 2017. We think that's probably more the ceiling for the price of oil. But in turn, at least from a trading basis, we think energy could do well in that environment. You know, really a significant underperformer over the past few years, finally showing some first signs of turning in the charts, both in absolute and relative terms.
So given where we are right now, we've got the Dow Jones Industrial Average at record levels, same with the transports. What would you be doing here? Would you be waiting for a pullback? Would you be adding money to these sectors you just described in a gradual basis, or maybe sit on the sidelines and wait for a better buying opportunity?
You know, from a near-term tactical basis, we've seen some of our sentiment indicators turn to more optimistic levels. So I would say that as far as the tactical conditions from early November have largely been utilized. Our take is that exposure to equities is warranted now. That if you haven't been in, I think you still have to get in even at these levels. But I would also say that these aren't the levels, the real attractive levels, the buy now levels. That I think if you are in equities, I think you maintain those positions and look to buy more on pullbacks. And, you know, just as far as a reasonable roadmap for what we can see over the coming months, I think what we saw from 2004 to 2006 for the S&P 500 makes for a very sensible roadmap. You know, when the Fed starts to tighten interest rates, you tend to see a more moderate pace of the rally. There's still going to be some ebbs and flows to it, but we think buying those pullbacks are more your tactical opportunities as far as when to add to positions.
Well, listen, Ari, I appreciate you coming on the program. If our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at Oppenheimer, how could they do so?
They could be in touch with their local Oppenheimer representative at their nearest branch office. They can follow me on Twitter at Ari Wald. And if they are interested in building a relationship, you know, please feel free to reach out and we could go through the steps towards making that happen.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Matthew Kirchhoff, contributor Dow Theory Letters and also the chief investment strategist at Model Investing, joins us today. And Matt, I want to ask you about a conversation we just had with Neil Dutt at Renaissance Macro. He's the head of economics there. And basically, his outlook is fairly positive when we think about the U.S. economy. We talked about the fact that the November print for unemployment is at 4.6%. It's at a 9-year low. So at least when we look at the official numbers, unemployment is low. We are at or near full employment. But with that being said, you know, one of the things that he said at the very end of that interview was how he thought there was actually a risk coming out of Washington if we see too much stimulus from the Trump administration. And, you know, particularly when we look at this $1 trillion infrastructure program that Donald Trump is proposing. And the reason for that is, I guess, because if we pump in all of this fiscal stimulus while we're at a 9-year low in unemployment, you know, there's some risks in terms of getting perhaps too much of a boom and inflationary risk and how that's going to translate to monetary policy and whether or not the Fed may be forced to raise interest rates quicker than expected if we see a lot of inflationary pressures building. So I want to get your thoughts on this because I do know that you wrote a recent note on sort of the boom and bust cycles that we see over time. How does that play into your view in terms of the need for creating thousands of new jobs, as Trump says, and this $1 trillion infrastructure program?
Well, first, it's great to be back on the show. Thanks for having me back. You know, I tend to agree with your guest's views on what's going on with the employment situation and the labor market at the moment. Her president-elect really ran on this campaign promise of creating an abundance of new jobs. But what's interesting is if you look at the data, our economy has been creating quite a few jobs. In fact, we've been creating above-trend numbers of jobs for the last 3, 4, 5 years. And so with the unemployment rate down to 4.6%, by most economists' definitions, that actually is full employment. And so at this point, if we do continue creating jobs, to your other guest's point, that does have the potential to create some negative feedback in the system. And so basically what we see is that around a 4.5 to 5% unemployment rate, demand and inflationary pressures within the economy tend to be roughly balanced. And obviously there's a range in which that occurs. But as you push unemployment lower and lower, what you actually start to see is the labor market truly heats up. We start to see rising wages. That often translates into higher inflation levels and therefore higher interest rates. In effect, kind of what we've been seeing lately. And as higher interest rates come onto the market, it's going to sort of redirect the flow of capital. We've seen bonds sell off quite a bit. And even though the market has been rallying as rates have risen recently, ultimately higher and higher rates are going to put a little bit of a limit on the appreciation of stocks as well.
After hitting a new low earlier in the year, gold became one of the best performing assets for 2016. It was supposed to go up even further. But since the election, gold has been in a downturn. Joining us on the program is John Ng from Maison Placements. John, let's talk about gold, because if you take a look at gold, it hit a low last year of around 1055, and then this summer got up to 1387, especially after Brexit. And of course, now we've had Trump's victory. We've also had the vote in Italy. It's gone in the opposite direction. Is this mainly due to the dollar, or what is causing, in your opinion, the decline in gold right now? Because this is typically a very strong seasonality for gold prices.
Well, Jim, that's the million-dollar question, and I've been asked that for the last 2 weeks. I mean, we saw the Dow Jones record 12 new record highs. The Dow Theory looks like it's going to support even higher markets, and so this Trump mania, before the election, the glass was half empty. Now the glass is considered half full. And the belief is that, as we all know, is that the stimulus, the tax cuts, it's the supply side theology is back. That was around during Ronald Reagan's day. And that would drive the economy much higher, and that would drive the stock market much higher. And so that enthusiasm has caused the U.S. dollar to not only be the haven of choice, but it looks like prosperity is here. While that sounds all very alluring, my sense is that it's a lot different from when Mr. Ronald Reagan was around. The deficit is, in fact, much higher. We know the debt load is $20 trillion. And so, notwithstanding all the great intentions of Trump and his team, he has got a straitjacket that he's got to deal with. But there's, I call the checking the golden boxes, and my sense is that this shift in market sentiment still has legs, but my sense also is that this is going to lead the seeds to much higher gold prices. Number one is reflation. I mean, there's no question that we're back to the old-fashioned spending. The tax cuts, which is sorely needed, are going to be put in place, and for a while, the shift from central banks, who were really dictating which way the economy should go, the unorthodox negative interest rates, quantitative easing, that is going to shift to, at long last, to fiscal policy, getting rid of the regulations. All that will be good, but it's also very expensive. An interesting point is that I did look at the election cycles going back to 1973. And when the Republicans were in, after the first year, there's something that the markets, in fact, were 23% higher under all the Republicans. When the Democrats got in power since 73, the gold in the election cycle only went up something like 5%. So Republicans are good for the gold price. So from a longer-term point of view, my sense is that this old-fashioned spending, this reflation, will be good for gold. The other aspect at work is the changing geopolitical climate. I mean, there'll be a shift in the geopolitical climate, which will also be good for gold. I say that the big gorilla or the elephant in the room is, of course, China. Is the sense is that Trump talked about a 45% tariff, and then there's a fear about getting involved in a trade war, and that I don't think that that's going to happen, notwithstanding the call with Taiwan and perhaps meeting the Dalai Lama. Those are irritants. I looked at the selection of Branstad, the Iowa governor, who is a old friend of Mr. Xi, considered a old friend of China. I think the long-term relation that Mr. Trump is at least in there for 4 years, Mr. Xi is in there for 8 years, and that I think that these two will get together. After all, China has $1.3 trillion of treasuries, and slapping a tax or threatening of slapping a tax, one could see tariffs on Boeing, iPhones, etc. That doesn't make sense to me. I mean, Mr. Trump is a transactional-minded individual, and we all know that when Obama got elected, he slapped the tax on tariffs on Chinese tires, and then within 6 months, he reversed himself when the Chinese put on tariffs. So while there are shades of the Dirty 30s and the Taft-Hawley Act, my sense is that's not going to happen. So we have a changing geopolitical climate. There will be tensions, and that's always, of course, I think in this time, will be good for gold. In China, interesting enough, is that the gold premiums are now widened to $46 an ounce. And that's, in fact, when you look at the Shanghai Gold Exchange, they are the largest physical player in the world now. And if you look at gold, the physical trading is trading now on average a 60% premium since April, since they introduced trading of physical gold. So my sense is China continues to be a buyer, just as Russia continues to be a buyer, and there's a solid underpinning to that. And I mentioned the changing geopolitical climate. We saw Italy, and yes, it didn't go up. Gold didn't go up, but we also know that the Italian banking system is also going down. 25% of their loans are not performing. So we're going to go through the Greek exit problem all over again. But the big point, I guess, I would make is that you have to look at Trump's appointments. That my sense is that 25% of the cabinet and proposed players are all hard money enthusiasts. Not many people talk about that. Robert Mercer, family, the hedge fund player, He has one of the largest contributors to Mr. Trump's campaign. In fact, his daughter contributed $4 million. She's on his transition team. Mr. Mercer has sponsored and is pushing for the resurrection of the gold standard. Judy Chow Shelton, also on the his transition team, pro-gold enthusiast. We have a lot of the players who subscribed to the 1984 and were signatories to the Jack Kemp Gold Standard Act. And I don't know whether you recall that during that time. That was a prelude actually to Reagan's second election and the supply side. But there was an attempt to get the Republicans talk of going back to a gold standard. So my sense is that his cabinet and Trump himself are hard money enthusiasts. So while I talk about reflation, on the other hand, what better way when you have reflation is get rid of all this funny money. And I think that we can look forward to a return to hard money, talking about hard money and gold and its proper role. So my expectation is that we are not going to see the lows that we saw, that we are forming the low in gold over the next few weeks. And I can see another $1,000 added to the price of gold. Gold is a hedge against, as we know, a classic hedge against currency depreciation. And that's why the Chinese are buying it a lot, because their currency has been going down. And the strong dollar, U.S. dollar, we've seen twice before where its strength has hurt the American economy, and thus there's an adjustment there. And when you see that adjustment, that will also be good for gold. So bottom line is that if when you check all these boxes that I talk about, my sense is that we are seeing a bottoming in gold, and the seeds of Trump's victory will be good for gold.
All right, let me throw some cold water on some of those things, because what we have seen since the election, we had the 10-year Treasury note. It was roughly, John, about 1.8% on the day you and I are doing this interview. It's at 2.4%. What if, for example, Trump comes in with stimulus, which he's vowed to do, in infrastructure spending, increasing more money spent on rebuilding the military. So those are inflationary, a tax cut. But on the other hand, what if the Fed starts getting aggressive? We've seen rates rise, and it's widely expected next week the Fed will raise interest rates a quarter of a point. What if, by chance, the inflation starts to heat up, as you say, which I can see coming, but the Fed counteracts that with rising interest rates? What would that do?
Well, I can recall, and I'm sure you can too, in the late 70s, when we had both rising interest rates and a rising gold price. It's a question of expectations, and I know the market is fearful of the uptick in rates, and that goes back to when Volcker sent it to double-digit levels. My sense is that you have to look at from the 70s perspective, and I do not think that rising interest rates will hurt gold.
So if they do start to rise, or let me give you another scenario. Let's say that Trump comes in, being a businessman, Barron's just had an article. One way not to raise the deficit would be to issue something like Build America bonds or a partnership with the private sector, where some of this is financed in the private sector rather than the public sector. So that's less inflationary. But what if, I guess, if there was something that was to thwart the rise in gold, in your opinion, what would that have to be?
Well, it's a question now, I believe, of supply demand, because we've so been long as far as the COMEX has, as we know, the sharp jabs down in gold have been because a lot of the futures have hit this market. And for some time, we've always said, yeah, the tightening physical market, and a lot of players bought physical gold for delivery on COMEX, and they just got rolled over. Well, the big gorilla this time is the advent and the resurrection, or the introduction of the Shanghai Gold Exchange. I mean, the deliveries on the Shanghai Gold Exchange are not just a few hundred tons. They're thousands of tons, 2,300 tons, the last report delivered off of. And so there's an arbitrage situation here, and that's why we are seeing the physical gold market tighten. And so my expectation is that's what's going to be the catalyst with respect to the market. So I can't see a big supply coming onto COMEX. I mean, in fact, quite the reverse. It's counterparty problems. That's why I think a lot of the bullion banks are very reticent to step in with when you see the demand coming in from China.
John, we know that there isn't a lot of gold in the COMEX to back up the, let's say, the volume and trading that occurs in gold futures. What would cause, and I've always wondered about this, and I've never seen it happen, but what would cause people to start demanding gold for delivery? Because most of the gold that trades in the world globally each day is paper gold. It's not physical gold. And what would cause, let's say, I don't know, a large hedge fund manager comes in and says, I want to take delivery. What would happen?
Well, we have actually witnessed periods from bank holidays. You can recall during the 08 crisis, British banks closed and there was literally a run on gold for fear that the banks would not open. 97 in Indonesia, the same thing happened with bank holidays. My sense is that, and this is not Mr. Trump's fault, but he's inherited a financial system that is leveraged, and actually Trump, some of programs will even more leverage the system. And there comes a time whereby, this is what he said, he's in a straitjacket, where that leverage reverses itself. And what causes that, of course, is higher rates, the unexpected higher rate scenario. With $20 trillion deficit, already 30-year, we've seen 100 basis point increase in the bond market. Bond market is, the 30-year bull market is, has ended. That's a fact of life. And now it's a different scenario. So Mr. Trump's election is an inflection point for the financial system, and it takes a long time to move this supertanker. And I think we have to have patience. And yes, the stock market looks very appealing, and it can grow in inflationary times. But so the end result is more inflation, and the classic hedge for inflation has always been gold. So my sense is that we just haven't looked across the valley, and that's why I expect much higher prices.
Let's talk about a possible catalyst, because when gold was bottoming in December of last year and early this year, a couple events happened. In February, the Bank of Japan went to negative interest rates. And also in February, when it was widely expected after raising interest rates in December, the Fed would be raising interest rates four times. Janet Yellen goes on Capitol Hill. All of a sudden, the Fed was taking a softening tone. And the combination of that and negative interest rates launched gold all the way up to almost $1,400. What do you think needs to be the catalyst? Is it a catalyst, some kind of event that would trigger another run-up as we saw starting in February of this year?
I think the horses have left the corral. We are so used to quantitative easing, and then we talked about it for years, the consequence of quantitative easing and negative interest rates and the balance sheets of the Fed. Now the European Central Bank is choking on debt, and that the EU can't buy anymore. The reality is now we're superimposing, in a Keynesian way, more spending. And the spending, it's great to talk about infrastructure, it's great to talk about tax cuts, and that will cause much higher growth. But with that growth, that's when we get classic too much money chasing too few goods. And that's the advent of the inflation that we see that we've been waiting for such a long time. We needed a spark, and we're just superimposing. If whether Clinton came in and she introduced more spending, or in Brexit, that more spending, it was pretty obvious that the central banks, the negative interest rates, was not working. And so there was already a clamor. In fact, Canada was hosted as a classic government where they introduced more spending, which is what we have done. Canada, we've put more spending. Our deficit has gotten even bigger. And that, in fact, we have seen pick up in inflation, mainstream inflation. And my sense is that if you're going to spend, you got to be able to pay for it. And we've just leveraged the system even more. But we are going to see mainstream inflation, unlike previous times.
As you look at the gold sector, even though gold was up since the beginning of the year, the gold stocks were up at one point over 100%. As you look at the gold market now, Let's talk about the gold sector and especially the companies. What's your view of companies and especially some of the larger companies who have been producing gold but aren't replacing the gold that they produce?
Well, that's the problem for the gold miners and the main dozen I looked at in the last little while. Last year, of the dozen major producers, only two replaced their reserves. And that's the problem is replacement of reserves. A lot of the industry, well, have cut in the cutback and in the interest of reducing their debt, they cut back their exploration programs, some development, Barrick, Pascua Lama, they went slow on that. And what that means is, of course, is fewer gold mines coming in the future. I looked at an interesting point is that China, as we know, is the largest producer in the world and also the largest consumer in the world. But their gold mines run out of ore by the year 2020. Well, that's a few years down the road. And so what's going to happen then is that they're either going to have to search for more gold, or I can see them buying, taking interest in some of the major deposits. For the gold mining industry in the West, you have Barrick with 90-odd million ounces of in-situ reserves. I value those reserves today at less than $300 an ounce. So what I'm saying is that the mining industry has really, because of they overspent and they created too much debt and they were mining gold at more than $1,200 an ounce, weren't making any money. Now they can make money at today's price because their costs, they've reduced by, in some cases, 20%. And some of them have free cash flow. But they haven't been able to find the new deposits of the future. And so a lot of them are living off of the previous discoveries. So there's really very little in the pipeline. So my sense is that when everybody will like gold again, a lot of money is going to go into the producers and it's going to cause premium prices.
So, John, given where the market is right now and where the price of gold is, we're at a level here below 1,200. What would you be doing? Would you be buying bullion or would you be buying stocks?
Well, I always like bullion. I mean, bullion is portable. Bullion is nice to look at. And I see an actual physical tightness for bullion. The stocks give you four times the leverage. So producers like Barrick, Agnico Eagle, the mid caps, the BT Golds, McEwen Mining, all look quite attractive. McEwen Mining and BT Gold have pipelines that they can grow organically. Barrick has free cash flow, and they've taken their net debt down from double digit down to $6 billion. And I think John Thornton's leadership has made a big difference. And down the road, we will hear a lot more from Barrick. Some of the other third-tier leverage ones like Yamana, IM Gold, Kinross, their assets are, I would say, mid-tier type of assets. And so their difficulty will be making money with a gold price at these levels. If you got a gold price of $1,300, $1,400, that's where the leverage is. But right now, I would stick to the low-cost producers such as the Barricks and the Eagles.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do, how can they do so, please?
Well, I publish every month, and some of the websites carry it, but our clients are the institutions and the state government, so the best way is to go to some of these websites, like yours.
Well, on January 20th, when President-elect Donald Trump takes the oath of office for President of the United States, the federal debt will be at $20 trillion, double what it was when Mr. Obama came in 8 years ago. He's also going to assume the presidency in a time of rising interest rates, radically different than when President Obama came in and President Obama's predecessor, President Bush. What does this mean for the future of where we are headed economically and for the Trump administration? All of that is the subject of The Big Picture coming up next here on the Financial Sense News Hour. As Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.